We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. According to a study published recently and approved by 195 countries, the worldwide impacts of the climate crisis are more severe than predicted, and there is only a narrow chance of securing a livable future for all. We now present you an article written by Damien Carrington. The piece is titled, IPCC Expert Warns UK Not Prepared for Climate Impacts. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to a lead author of a report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, the United Kingdom is very much not adapted to climate change and not prepared. The study, published recently and approved by 195 countries, says the worldwide impacts of the climate crisis are more severe than predicted, and there is only a narrow chance of securing a livable future for all. The report says in the United Kingdom, more flooding from rivers, at the coasts, and from intense downpours in urban areas is one of the biggest impacts of climate change. Sewage works, airports and seaports are among the key infrastructure at risk, along with the impacts of storms on the electricity and communication networks. While doubling in frequency within decades, the report says winters are getting wetter, summers are becoming drier, and water shortages are on track to increase in England and Wales. Heat waves are also a rising and deadly threat, with many homes and hospitals unprepared in the United Kingdom. According to a study cited in the report, one in three heat-related deaths in the UK between 1991 and 2018 were caused by global heating. The report says global climate impacts will also cause shortages of imported goods and increase their price in the United Kingdom, as well as damaging markets for British exports. The report even warns of financial instability due to economic shocks caused by climate change. Professor Richard Betts at the UK Meteorological Office and a lead author of both the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report and the CCRA said, "The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report backs up the conclusions of the UK Climate Change Risk Assessment, or CCRA, published in 2021. Professor Richard Betts added, "The key point is that the United Kingdom is very much not adapted to climate change and not prepared." Sir Patrick Vallance, the Chief Scientific Advisor to the UK Government, responded to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report by warning of increasing extreme weather in the United Kingdom. Professor Patrick Vallance said, "This will strain housing, agriculture, transport and supply chains, little of which was built with such pressure in mind." He also warned of more wildfires endangering cities near moorland, such as in Manchester and Sheffield. Sir Patrick Vallance said, "The challenge is enormous, but it can be met." The IPCC report, which is based on 34,000 scientific studies, says that over the past three decades, Britain and Europe have experienced the highest number of river floods in the past 500 years. It says some coastal communities in Britain may have to move inland and that the number of people at risk of annual coastal flooding in the United Kingdom would rise from 3.2 million to more than 5 million in a worst-case scenario. Mike Moorcroft at Natural England and one of the 234 lead authors of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report said, "As an island nation, what happens on the coast of Britain is a particular issue." But he said restoring nature on the coasts could provide better protection than hard defences such as the Stirred Salt Marshes in Somerset. Peter Alexander at the University of Edinburgh and another IPCC author said climate impacts on farming in Britain and around the world affected people. Peter Alexander said, "We are part of a global food system. We import close to half the food that we consume, and if the rest of the world's agriculture is being impacted by climate change, then we're going to effectively import those impacts to the United Kingdom, largely through potentially higher food prices." The Climate Change Committee, the CCC, the British government's official advisers, said in June of 2021 the government was failing to protect people from the fast-rising risk of the climate crisis, with action to improve resilience not keeping pace with the impacts of global heating. The Climate Change Committee experts said they were frustrated by the absolutely illogical lack of sufficient action on adaptation, given that taking action is up to 10 times more cost-effective than not doing so. The British government acknowledged in its legally required assessment of climate risk published in January, "We must go much further and faster to truly prepare for the impacts of a warmer world," adding, "In the majority of risk areas, we need to take more action." A British government spokesperson said the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report was stark, claiming, "We are working at pace on our national adaptation program due in 2023, with robust measures including £5.2 billion to tackle flooding and coastal erosion in the United Kingdom." The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report strongly emphasises that the climate crisis hits the poor, vulnerable and excluded in society the most, and that addressing inequality is an essential part of tackling global heating. Professor Lindsay Stringer at the University of York and an Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change author said, "Different segments of the population can be more or less vulnerable, and that applies not just in developing countries, but within the United Kingdom as well." The chair of the Climate Change Committee's Adaptation Committee, Julia King, writing with the former chair, John Krebs, said, "Adaptation should be integral to levelling up in the United Kingdom. Poorer households are more severely affected by the health and financial consequences of flooding and other extreme weather events." They said, "Britain has the capacity and the resources to adapt, but the government is simply not doing enough." They added, "Lack of action now is storing up problems and costs for future generations. They will have to pay for our negligence."
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The political crisis in Libya took a turn for the worse recently, with the Tobruk-based House of Representatives in the country's east choosing former Interior Minister Fatih Beshagha as Prime Minister, while current Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dbeibah has vowed to continue in the post until an election is held.
I will accept no new transitional phase, and we will not step up from our role in the government that we promised the people until an election is held.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Now, today we are focusing on the unfolding political crisis in Libya, a country that now has two rival prime ministers. Now, this latest development counters UN efforts to reconcile the divided country. We are asking, will this North African state slide back into a civil war? In the second part of our program, we shall move to neighboring Sudan, where the military regime has continued its brutal crackdown on peaceful protesters calling for a return to civilian rule. Will the military give in to the demands by the masses? Stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Libya, one country, two prime ministers. On the 10th of February, the House of Representatives, based in eastern Libya, named former Interior Minister Fati Beshaga to form a new government replacing incumbent Abdelhamid Dbeibah. The parliament argues that the mandate of Dbeibah's government had expired on the 24th of December when elections were scheduled to be held. Differences amongst Libyan political groups led to the indefinite postponement of the eagerly awaited polls. Dbeibah insists that he will accept no new transitional phase or parallel authority and will hand over power only to an elected government.
The United Nations says it still recognizes Dbeibah as Libya's interim prime minister. He is a spokesman for UN Secretary General at a news conference.
Yesterday, Ms. Williams met with Prime Minister Abdelmahid Dbeibah to discuss recent developments and the votes taken by the House of Representatives to adopt a constitutional amendment and designate a new prime minister. Ms. Williams reiterated the importance of all actors and institutions to work within the political framework and, above all, to preserve calm on the ground in the interest of Libya's unity and stability.
Now, to discuss the ongoing events in Libya, we contacted Mustafa Feturi, an independent Libyan academic and journalist. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time.
Pleasure to be with you again. Thank you for having me.
Now, Mr. Feturi, Libya now has two prime ministers. Now, was there any legal basis that the Tobruk-based parliament relied on when it elected a new prime minister?
Well, of course, it's considered as a legal process because for several reasons. First of all, Mr. Dbeibah's mandate was about to finish last December when the elections take place. That never happened. The elections did not take place. But many considered his continuation of being a prime minister, a caretaker prime minister, actually, because he lost the vote of confidence last September, as we mentioned earlier. Many considered that to be illegal. He should not be there, even though he is just a caretaker prime minister. That's one thing. The other thing, the parliament has the upper hand in this case, because without the confidence of the parliament, legally speaking, in a democratic process, however broken the process is, the parliament is supposed to be the authority in the country that decides who becomes the prime minister by voting and selection of names, you know, different names, and that's what happened. So it's in terms of being legal or not, I think it's quite legal. It also goes in accordance with the UN brokered agreement between the different Libyan factions that was signed in March last year in Geneva, and that brought in through what is known as the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum and meeting in Geneva, that selected Mr. Dbeibah as a prime minister.
Different scenarios are emerging regarding the situation in Libya. One of the most likely scenarios is that the Dabeiba government will continue to work, but Bashagha also establishes a parallel government as he promised upon his appointment by Parliament.
I would like to thank the government of national unity headed by Abdulhamid Dabeiba, who took on the responsibilities during a difficult phase. This is the democracy that ensures a peaceful transition of power, and I am confident that the government of national unity will be committed to these democratic principles.
Is there a risk of Libya sliding back to civil war if action is not taken to reconcile the warring factions?
The risk of going back to violence in the country at this time, because of this development, I think it's very minimal. Why? Two reasons. One is the fact that it is not something we have seen before, like the division between east of the country and west of the country. The strongest man in the east of the country who controls power on the ground, Mr. Khalifa Haftar, who leads the Libyan army over there, is supporting the selection of Mr. Bashagha. The second reason, we have to remember that Mr. Bashagha, as well as the current prime minister, acting prime minister, Mr. Dabeiba, are Misratins from the western Libyan city of Misrata, east of Tripoli. And that to see them fighting, actually, if any fight will happen, it will happen either in Tripoli, the capital, over the location of power and the seat of power, or in Misrata, their hometown. And Misratans, social leadership as well as political figures, very unlikely to support this or let it happen.
Libyan Prime Minister Abdulhamid Dabeiba survived an apparent assassination attempt when bullets hit his car on the day a rival prime minister was elected. Now, the failed assassination came as armed groups mobilized more fighters and equipment in the capital over recent weeks amid concern that the political crisis could trigger fighting. Now, Mr. Fituri, do we have indications on who was actually involved in this assassination attempt?
Well, the whole affair about this assassination attempt is very unclear, to say the least. I don't think there is any political motivation behind such an assassination attempt, and it's of course condemned, and it's total terrorism, if you like. But at the same time, having said this, I really doubt if something like this has happened, and if it did happen, I have to emphasize this. It has not been fully investigated, first of all. Second, it's very unlikely that any political party was behind this. And the third, we have to also indicate this fact that he's in Tripoli. And in Tripoli, there are dozens of armed militias. Not all of them are happy with him.
While the politicians tussle for power in Libya, for the common man in the street, the main concern remains the high cost of living. Libya topped the Maghreb countries in the consumer inflation rates during the past year, 2021.
People struggle to make ends meet. The cost of living is obscene. The state's budget is billions, while citizens have no hope whatsoever.
Libya plunged into chaos following the killing of the country's Muammar Gaddafi during a NATO operation. Since the fall of Gaddafi's authoritarian regime, Libya has been plagued by US-instigated violence, chaos, and terrorism. Now, as Europe's natural gas stability appears increasingly fragile due to the crisis in Ukraine, Libya is now seen as one of the supply alternatives. This has resulted in increased foreign meddling in this energy-rich North African country. Libya's political crisis has attracted imperialist and regional powers, specifically the United States, France, and the EU.
Other countries said to be part of the mix in Libya include Arab states of the Persian Gulf, Turkey, and neighboring Egypt, which support opposite ends of power. Now, a last question to you, Mr. Fitouri. There have been reports of foreign involvement in Libya over the recent past. Now, are foreign powers involved in the current political stalemate in Libya?
Of course. Of course. The main problem in Libya since 2011, 11 years ago, has always been the foreign interference. You have conflicting interests for different countries, and the theater of conflict, if you like, the theater of conflict is Libya. So that has always been there. At the current political impasse, if you like, we have different countries that do not wish to see elections taking place, mainly because they believe whoever is coming might not serve their interests, might not help them help their vision or strategy in the long run in Libya. And there are those who try to spoil the whole thing, so Libya becomes more chaotic and easy to control. The foreign interference, unfortunately, has always been the problem in Libya since 2011.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fitouri. As always, it's always great having you in our show. Now, let's take a short break. Our next subject will be on the continued crackdown of peaceful demonstrators in Sudan by the country's military. Stay with us.
Sudan's brutal crackdown.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Sudanese armed forces have continued their brutal crackdown on peaceful demonstrators across the country, demanding an end to the military rule. Protesters also want to see the release of political prisoners and justice for dozens of protesters killed since last year's coup.
These regular mass protests have been held in Sudan since October the 25th coup, led by Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, which derailed the country's rocky transition to civilian rule following a 2019 removal of longtime dictator Omar al-Bashir.
A demonstrator speaks here on the demands by the masses in the country.
We here and Sudanese everywhere have come out for the same reason today. We want freedom, peace and justice. We want a complete civilian government without the military. The military should stay in their barracks and focus on the country's security at the borders and not get in governance. No military will rule this country. This country is the country of the people. The government is for the people and the military should be in the barracks.
Now, for more on the fragile situation in Sudan, we contacted Julius Mbaluto, an African affairs analyst. Now, at least 80 protesters have been killed by Sudanese security forces since the coup occurred in 2021. It appears the military junta is clinging to power with an iron fist. Mr. Mbaluto, what's your take on this?
We've seen military making different approaches to appease the protest. Of course, we saw their latest move when they tried to free the former prime minister, and then in a minute they tried to contain him because they signed an agreement with him to carry on with their leadership, but also including him. But he didn't have much say about it, making him ending up in a resign. And of course, since that time, all we have seen in Sudan, it just continues protest, because you know, I think the Sudanese have come to realize that the military is not serious in terms of changing. They just want to carry on as normal. They want to rule. They kicked off the civilian part of leadership in the coalition, and now it's just the military, basically. So they seem to be very desperate to frustrate all these people until they just accept that rulership.
Relentless protests have rocked Sudan since the military coup last October. Fresh crackdowns on protesters will likely complicate UN efforts to find a way out of the country's crisis. The UN spokesman elaborates here on the ongoing efforts to reconcile warring parties in Sudan.
Turning to Sudan, the first stage of the UN's facilitated consultations for political process on the way forward has concluded. The first stage began on January 8th and brought together a range of groups, including civil society, women's rights groups, political parties, academics, journalists, and others. The Secretary General's Special Representatives in Sudan, Volker Perthes, said he heard a range of perspectives and proposals from the Sudanese people to overcome the current political crisis. He expressed his gratitude for the commitment and enthusiasm of representatives of groups from across Sudan who came to meet with the UN, engage constructively and share their concrete ideas.
Despite the brutal crackdown in Sudan, the masses have continued with their protests, demanding a return to civilian rule. What are the driving forces behind the consistency in these protests?
And these are determined activists who will not let go, and they're also instrumental to the protests globally against, you know, hanging on to power of former President Omar Bashir. But you see, they are still the same, you know, they've gone back to Sudan because they realized Omar Bashir is gone, but now the greatest enemy in terms of dictatorship hanging on to power and democratically has been the military. They are already on the ground organizing and facilitating and overseeing the protests. And these are the people right now whom the military is focusing on in terms of abduction, in terms of detaining them without even any formal trial.
Sudan's military ruler, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, confirmed meetings between Sudanese and Israeli regime officials, claiming they were for security cooperation, not politics. Sudanese masses and political parties have already rejected the military regime's decision to normalize relations with the Israeli regime.
When we talk about the normalization deal with Israel, I think it was a big mistake that will stoke division in Sudan. Many parties in the transitional government have rejected this deal. It will be rejected by the Sudanese people as well. It was a personal decision by members of the government like Burhan and Hamdok. This deal will be resisted by other parties and by the Sudanese people themselves.
Is the Sudanese military leadership increasing its brutal crackdown on civilians due to support by some Western powers and the Israeli regime?
When it comes to global engagement, we have seen a lot of countries, US, Britain, UK as well, talking about, we want return to civilian leadership in Sudan. And therefore, this is not the time some countries to begin to, you know, take these guys very lightly and friendly. No, it's time to say no civilian government, no engagement. And therefore, that's where things go wrong. When it comes to some countries are pro the military junta, others are not. It won't work for the Sudanese people. And I say most of the time when you imagine yourself living in a country since independence, there's never been democratic rule. It's all coups and stuff. No, it's not the way to go. The way to go is let the Sudanese people, civilian leadership, have the prominence, focus, be the thing that everybody wants.
Sudan's strategic location and its resources, especially oil and vast agricultural land, have made it attractive to imperialist powers meddling in the region, especially the United States and the Israeli regime. Now, these imperialist powers have long-term interests in weakening the Republic of Sudan And this was actually the reason they encouraged South Sudan to break away in 2011. Now, foreign powers have for a long time been interfering in Sudan, and this has exacerbated the crisis in this country. Now, in your opinion, what's the reason for this meddling?
Sudan is an amazing country, you know, technically, because of civil war, it broke into the Sudan and, of course, South Sudan. And the international community, different countries have employed different measures to be the ones who benefit. I'll give you an example. During when United Nations gave arms embargo, which means no country was supposed to sell arms to the Sudanese government in Khartoum. China was still against the UN embargo, selling arms to the government in Khartoum. Yet again, the same country, China, was also brokering deals of oil production within South Sudan. So in South Sudan, they are brokering deals of oil production. In the north, they are selling arms. And when you challenge them, they say it's just business. Business, arms are for sale. Okay, oil, yeah, it's business. We have agreements, we have contracts. You have all these international players. Most of the time, it happens to be focus on resources rather than stability of that country and the sovereignty of that country. So it's still the same ploy. When you look into any other different international community in different countries, most of these countries are for themselves rather than for the individual Sudanese people.
While announcing his resignation early January, Sudan's Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok said the country was at a dangerous turning point threatening its survival. For several years, massive anti-government demonstrations have been taking place in Sudan, mostly over economy. The protesters, youth for a large part, demanded the resignation of then-President Omar al-Bashir. A demonstrator who took part in those protests says they will not relent until their demands are met.
I took part in the 2013, 2016 and 2018 protests against Bashir. And here I am now and will continue to protest until our demands are met. I will keep protesting until there is a civilian government and there is peace, freedom and justice.
Now that clearly shows the firm resolve and determination of the Sudanese people in attaining their rights. Mr. Mbaluto, do you think the Sudanese military will eventually give in to the demands of the masses?
With the sustained protests going on, with the lack of relenting within the protesters' fraternity and leadership, it's not giving up, I think, and also lack of a lot of endorsement by this military junta over there in Sudan, it's like a setup whereby you'll never go forever. Not quite. Because at some point, you just realize, oh, you can't continue. You cannot keep this going. I believe AU as well, Africa Union, will be very, keen to see that civilian leadership comes back to Sudan. So when you look into the future, I don't see the military having a greater future there. But the challenge is to send military to facilitate change in Sudan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Baluto, for your time. It's been great having you. Now, and as our guest said, the main challenge in Sudan remains the unwillingness of the military to facilitate transition to civilian rule. Now, we shall keep our eyes on Sudan and give you up-to-date analysis. Now that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. Drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
In mid-1358, which equals to 1979, Tabriz faced a revolutionary attack. In Tabriz itself, there were a small number of vicious elements, but most of them poured to Tabriz from outside that city. They were also helped in some way from the center. Those disruptors were helped by some people. As a result, some individuals were worried. We were raising this issue at that time in the Revolutionary Council. Some individuals were really concerned. However, Imam said that the zealous people of Tabriz themselves would solve the problem and that no one needed to interfere. This was Imam's logic. In his speech, Imam also stated this. He said that Tabriz does not need the intervention of others as Tabriz itself will calm the troubled waters. And that is exactly what it did. Shahid Madani, who was the Friday prayer leader of Tabriz at that time, replacing Shahid Ghazi, may God bestow paradise on him, was in the middle of the arena that day. Shahid Madani himself was in the middle of the ground, and the youth of Tabriz increasingly gathered behind him. Thousands of young people accompanied him and were able to overcome this conspiracy. Imam's move, outlook, and behavior brought about such a great success. That was a step. Such was the nature of Imam's work.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
One important example of Imam's acumen in helping the continuity of the revolution and the revolutionary move was the measures that he adopted during the sacred defense era. From the first day when Saddam's attack on some airports and areas began until the last day of the eight-year war and the adoption of the resolution, Imam would constantly encourage and breathe new life into the soldiers, the people, the supporters, and the officials of the country. In fact, Imam turned the war that was imposed on the Iranian nation into a tool to show the power of the nation. Well, we were really empty-handed inside the country. We were empty of weapons, of facilities, and of a regular and of a regular organization in the face of the enemy.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you.
that you've got, you've got for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
In the limelight.
According to the UN, in 2021, 342 Palestinians, most of them civilians, were killed by the Zionist regime across Palestine, including 86 children. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written by Jessica Baxbaum, journalist. This article is titled Zionist regime violence intensifying as 2021 proves deadliest for Palestinians since 2014. Stay tuned for more. On December 10th, Jamil Abu Ayyash, 31, was shot in the head by the Zionist regime troops during anti-settlement demonstrations in Beita, a village south of Nablus in the occupied West Bank. Abu Ayyash succumbed to his injuries. 3 days later, the Zionist regime army fatally shot Jamil al-Kayal, also 31, in the head during an early morning raid in Nablus. And the beginning of December was marked by two other killings within 2 days of each other. On December 4th, the Zionist regime border police shot and killed Muhammad Shaukat Salama, 23. And on December 6th, the Zionist regime guards fatally shot 16-year-old Muhammad Nidal Yunus. The latest string of killings by the Zionist regime forces follows the same predictable pattern of Israeli regime violence against Palestinians, but with one significant distinction. The Zionist regime's violence is intensifying, as 2021 is proving to be the deadliest for Palestinians since 2014. In its latest Protection of Civilians report, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, said that more than 70 Palestinians have been killed by the Zionist regime forces in the West Bank and occupied East al-Quds this year. This figure stands in stark contrast to previous years. In 2020, 24 Palestinians were killed in the West Bank, and in 2019, 27 were killed. Concerns about excessive use of force by Israeli troops resulting in the killing or serious injury of Palestinians, as well as lack of accountability for such violations of international law, remain, OCHA wrote in its 2022 humanitarian needs overview for the occupied Palestinian territories. In 2021, over 1,000 have been injured by live ammunition, it added. The UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, also raised concerns over the shooting death of Salama at Damascus Gate earlier this month, calling it an apparent extrajudicial execution. In a Facebook post, OHCHR questioned, "Extrajudicial killings such as this are the consequence of the regular resort to lethal force by well-armed and well-protected Israeli security personnel against Palestinians, and the almost total lack of accountability for killings and injuries of Palestinians by Israeli forces. Will there be accountability in this case? In Gaza, civilian casualties are just as alarming. A study by Air Wars, a nonprofit tracking civilian harm, revealed Israeli regime strikes on Gaza killed up to 10 times more civilians during its 11-day assault in May than had its 8-year bombing campaign against forces in Syria. The researchers found Israeli regime airstrikes killed between 151 and 192 civilians in Gaza, a third of whom were children. The Zionist regime army often justified its military actions in Gaza as targeting militants, but Air Wars found that in over 80% of attacks against civilians, no member of militants were reported injured or killed. According to UN data, 2021 has seen the most Palestinian casualties since 2014, when the Zionist regime launched a war against Gaza known as Operation Protective Edge. In 2021, to date, 342 Palestinians have been killed by the Zionist regime across Palestine. This year's Israeli regime violence stems mostly from the Israeli assault on Gaza in May and the ongoing anti-colonization protests in Beita. Abu Ayyash was the 9th Palestinian to be killed since May by the Zionist regime troops during the weekly demonstrations. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights, PCHR, asserted excessive force was used in Abu Ayyash's death, writing in a press release that the Israeli regime army directly targeted the Palestinian civilians in the head. In its statement, PCHR detailed that an eyewitness said to PCHR's field worker that an Israeli troop fired 2 bullets from 40 to 50 meters on the top of the mound. One of the bullets was in the air while the other hit Jamil Abu Ayyash, who was in front of the troop, trying to turn back and fled away. Meanwhile, Abu Ayyash did not pose any imminent threat to the troops' lives. Abu Ayyash was shot in the back of the head and fell on the ground. PCHR reiterated, "These crimes reflect the excessive use of force in circumstances where there was no imminent threat to the troops' lives and prove the Zionist regime occupation forces' lenient shooting standards against the Palestinian civilians." Beita's deputy mayor, Musa Hamayel, described the protest against the establishment of Aviatar outpost as peaceful marches. "We haven't used any kind of weapon against settlers. All that happens on the mountain is peaceful, popular resistance," Musa told Minpress News, adding, "just burning tires and using some torches and lights." Musa explained, referring to the night confusion method of protesting, "This form of demonstration incorporates sound and light to disturb the nearby settlers. Because Israel is convinced of the importance of this outpost for the Israeli side, they use violence." The Zionist regime army has tried suppressing the protest with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets, which Musa said are being aimed at the upper body parts of the protesters, including their hands. The UN's Chemical Weapons Convention in 1993 banned the use of riot control agents like tear gas in warfare. And 2018 Geneva guidelines stipulate rubber-coated steel bullets should be fired toward the lower parts of the body and not aimed at the head. All 9 Palestinians killed in Beitar this year were shot with live fire either in the head, chest, or abdomen. The Israeli regime army did not respond to requests for comment on its use of rubber-coated steel bullets against Beitar residents. Documentation from non-governmental organization Defense for Children International, Palestine DCIP reported 86 Palestinian children have been killed in the occupied Palestinian territory since January, making 2021 the deadliest year on record for Palestinian children since 2014. According to DCIP, the Zionist regime forces killed 76 Palestinian children, 61 in Gaza and 15 in the West Bank and East Al-Quds. The Zionist regime forces killed 17 Palestinian children using live ammunition in 2021, with at least 9 fatally shot during demonstrations or clashes. In its press release, DCIP wrote, "Under international law, intentional lethal force is only justified in circumstances where a direct threat to life or of serious injury is present. However, investigations and evidence collected by DCIP suggest that Israeli forces use lethal force against Palestinian children in circumstances that may amount to extrajudicial or willful killings." Ayat Abu Ektiash, Accountability Program Director at DCIP, added, "The international community's lack of political will to hold Israeli officials accountable guarantees that Israeli troops will continue to unlawfully kill Palestinian children with impunity." Saeed Hamayel understands the pain of losing a child. The father of 5 lost his firstborn, Mohammed Saeed Hamayel, on June 11th, when the Zionist regime troops shot the 16-year-old in the chest during the protests in Beitar. Saeed described how the single bullet that hit Mohammed caused damage to his heart and lungs, fractured parts of his rib cage, and created a 3-inch hole in his body. "They shot him with live fire in order to kill him," Saeed said. "It was an intentional killing." Saeed said the Zionist regime army never gave an explanation for his son's killing. The Zionist regime army did not respond to mint press requests for comment on minors killed during the Beitar protests.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A huge number of Ukrainian refugees continue to arrive at EU borders in Poland, Slovakia, Romania and Hungary. On Thursday, EU Home Affairs ministers adopted the Temporary Protection Directive. It means the refugees can work and go to school in any of the bloc's 27 member states for at least 1 year.
If you compare to the refugees that came in 2015, how long time it took to have the proper decisions. For example, just to have their asylum applications processed, it could take years.
So, by the EU's own admission, refugees travelling here from conflict zones involving Western military powers did not and do not receive the same protection. Meanwhile, advocates are calling on the EU to pay particular attention to certain groups.
In general, people who are displaced in a forced way are vulnerable. But we want to call attention to specifically the situation of women and girls because they are disproportionately affected.
European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen travelled to Slovakia and Romania on Thursday to assess the refugee crises facing the two EU nations. She took the opportunity to try and apply additional pressure on Moscow.
The three waves of sanctions we introduced are already having an impact on the Russian economy and therefore Putin's war effort. And we will take additional steps if the situation deteriorates on the ground.
Non-EU country Moldova has taken in more than 100,000 Ukrainian refugees so far. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell visited the country on Thursday to offer support. However, there is concern over the treatment of some who are trying to reach the EU from Ukraine. Senior UN officials are criticising evidence of discrimination by EU border authorities against African and Asian nationals attempting to flee the conflict. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Press TV, Brussels.
Al-Fajr cultural days have kicked off, but this time it is not held in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Rather, Beirut is hosting the event like many other Iranian art exhibitions held here.
Activities include many art activities, theater, music, exhibition, seminars and other activities.
The Iranian Minister of Culture opened the festivals with an awe-inspiring musical concert. Iranian musicians there are glad to be attending such an event.
I'm a musician from Iran. I play oud, a common instrument in Muslim world. I really like the Arabic culture, Arabic countries' cultures. By myself, and I think the collaboration between Muslim countries, it would be good. Something like Fajr days in Lebanon, and I really enjoy my stay in Lebanon.
The many facets of Iran's artistic culture have come all the way to Lebanon, from the folklore dress to poetry.